Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior wood stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture. It repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Our knowledgeable team is ready to help bring your dreams to life, 1 gallon at a time. Stop by your local Menards today.
Welcome to part two of our interview about haunted Chicago. Thank you for supporting the program and keeping us on the air. Another place that I personally haven't been to in years, but as a child loved to go and visit. And I was unaware of the ghosts here, but I'd love to hear your findings. The Museum of Science and Industry.
Oh, yeah, that was strange because I was not expecting that. I had heard a rumor about... Well, one thing I heard was that supposedly, and I guess this is true, when William Jennings Bryan, you know, the great orator and everything else, and it was Clarence Darrow, the famous lawyer and everything else. Apparently when he died, he was cremated and he had his ashes distributed in the pond that is right outside the museum. And I guess that's a true story. And so people say, well, they see the ghost of Clarence Darrow there in the museum, which is kind of interesting. So I'd heard that and I thought, well, maybe I'll just, you know, follow up on that and see what's going on. But as I went to the museum, I was just talking to the various docents that are working there. I got some other stories. And one of them was about, there's a train there from the 1930s called the Zephyr. And it's one of these, silver streamliners that we had in the 30s that were such beautiful trains, cross-country trains. And so they have one there. They have the Zephyr there. And it has, you can take a tour, you can walk through the Zephyr and you can see the furnishings and the various cars and all that. And then there's a car in the rear, which is sort of like, I guess like an observation car. It has like a lot of windows around to the rear and the side. So you can sit back there and you can watch the countryside as you're passing through. And they have these animatronic figures, sort of like you see in Disneyland, you know, a mother and a father and children. And there's a kind of a cheesy voiceover, you know, about the family talking like, "Hey, Dad, look out the window. Are those cows?" You know, mm-hmm. "Yes, son, those are cows." You know, so you get that kind of thing. But they're kind of creepy looking in their own right because they are just, you know, sort of weird. But what one of the docents told me is that they have seen these figures moving even before the museum is open. Like they're there earlier and they're getting things set up and they actually seen the figures move on their own before anything is turned on to actually animate them. So they don't know what that's about, but they're a little leery of that, which I would understand. They can't seem to find a history on this Zephyr of anybody maybe dying or, you know, a suicide or a murder or anything like that that would sort of instigate a ghost story, but they've seen this happen. But the other thing that happens there, I think is even more interesting, is there's a German sub, a World War II German submarine there called the U-505. Now, when I was there, it was under, it was being renovated and rebuilt and whatever. I understand now that the museum has it on exhibit, it's fully open. But the story with this is that during the war, one of the German captain of the ship at this time apparently either just cracked under pressure. The story was that they were underwater and that they were under attack by Allied ships that were dumping depth charges down on the boat and everything else like that, and that this guy, the commander, basically lost it, that he apparently just just couldn't handle any more tension and cracked under the pressure. And so he pulled out his pistol and he shot himself on the sub, which meant that, you know, the second in command obviously took over and everything else. But so we have a suicide on board this. Now, the ship was captured later on by the Allies. The boat was captured, and I don't know how it got to the museum, but eventually got to the museum. So they've had docents. They say, now, you can go on to it. You can go walk through the sub. But the docents come in early, and they have to turn on all the lights in the sub. Now, to do that, they have to actually walk the full length of it. So part of the time, they're walking the sub in darkness until they get to the place where they can turn on a light and light that section up. And some of them have said that they have felt, as soon as they got on it, you know, walking through the dark of the sub, that they have felt just uneasy, you know, felt anxious, uneasy. And I talked to one of them who said that, you know, she felt somebody pushed her. So she felt actually somebody shove her, and she, you know, she ran out. And another person said that he felt like something kind of grabbed at his shirt, like kind of pulling him back or something. So they believe that the captain is still on board there. And, you know, they've had these physical experiences with him. They haven't seen him, but they've had these physical experiences of being, you know, touched, or I don't want to say attacked, but yeah, you know, touched and everything else by something unseen in the dark.
It's a place where I too was surprised to hear ghost stories, but at the same point, when you think about it, you go, actually, logically, this place would probably be packed with ghosts with the artifacts that they have in there and the energy that surrounds them. I don't know why I was feeling surprised about that, but you know, upon discussing it further, I'm not surprised whatsoever.
Right. Well, and as you know, and as you mentioned, there is a theory that ghosts can attach themselves to inanimate objects. Yep. You know, so if somebody committed suicide on a train or a sub or something, and you have that in your possession, it's liable. It's possible that spirit might still be there.
Yeah, so, we have where I live in Branson, Missouri. We have the Titanic Museum, which is a half scale, half of the ship. Literally, it looks like the boat's cut in half. It's the strangest thing to look at when you're eating at the salad bar at Ruby Tuesdays. There's the Titanic out the window. But there is activity there that's been documented of, they think, a child playing in a certain area of the ship. And there are several artifacts from the ship itself on display. And I do not consider myself as sensitive, but I have family members who do, including one who doesn't really realize it yet because she's six now. She's about four when this happened. But there was an area she just refused. She did not want to go into. And there, it was not, you know, visually scary. There was nothing about it that would have made you hold back, but there was a vibe there. Yeah. And my wife had felt it as well. Just, you know, there's something about museums that document historical tragedies or things of that nature that seem to hold a lot of energy.
Right.
Let's talk about,
well, you know,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, just as an aside from that, when I mentioned Ed and Lorraine Warren earlier in the show here, and at their home in Connecticut, Ed has since passed away, mm-hmm. but at Lorraine's home in Connecticut, they have what they call the Occult Museum.
Yeah.
That's literally a barn. I mean, I've seen it. And in there, they have all these objects that have had some connection with hauntings or possession, and they protect them. Yeah. You know, they keep them under security because they believe that there is still something, you know, attached to them, whether you want to call it a force or a spirit or whatever, but something there. So yeah, there's a lot of that.
Yeah, there definitely is. Let's move, as we continue our conversation here about the Chicago area, more to the north area. I know there's several areas you documented in the book as well. What are some of those that stand out to you?
In the north. Well, I'm not sure my geography. I mentioned Thornton before, which is sort of the north area.
That is true.
There's Bachelor's Grove is out there.
Area. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. But, and Bachelor's Grove, this is interesting. I'm not sure. That's actually in Midlothian, I guess.
Yes.
And I'm trying to piece my Chicago geography here, living in Cincinnati, but that was sort of up in that area. The interesting thing about that was that this has a long, long history of being haunted. And there's all kinds of stories coming from Bachelor's Grove, some that just sound really incredible, you know, and just, I'll say incredible, truly incredible, in a sense of unbelievable. But what I found interesting was that we were there, my wife and I went there, and there's not much left in this old cemetery. There's probably only well, I'll bet there's probably not more than 4 or 5 tombstones that are there. The rest are all gone, and it's gone to weeds, and it's not a maintained cemetery by any means. There's a famous picture, though, that somebody took, and I don't know exactly the year, but it's a famous Bachelor's Grove picture. And if somebody just did Bachelor's Grove ghost and put that in a search on the internet, it'll probably come right away. It shows a woman sitting on what looks like a tombstone. And she's just sitting there very sort of calmly and reflectively, but she's got a long kind of gown on, clearly an older style. And it's a misty sort of picture, but it's certainly identifiable as a woman. And supposedly, I don't know who took that picture, but it's been circulating for many years as one of the ghosts at Bachelor's Grove. But while we were there, you park the car on the road, and you can't drive, and it's a gravel road, but it's chained off, so you have to park your car outside, then you have to walk down this road maybe 100 yards or so, and then, like I said, you're walking through a path through woods. When you get to the cemetery, it's all just weedy and it's overgrown, but you know, you can see some of the stones that are there. So we were there, and there wasn't anybody else, just my wife and I, and we're walking around, we're just looking at some of the stones. And then when I looked up, there was a guy, there was a man standing in the cemetery on the other side of it, the other side of this field. And he was wearing a white shirt and black pants and, you know, modern attire. Wasn't anything unusual about him. But he was just kind of standing there looking at, I don't know if it was a stone or not, because like I said, there's very few, but he's sort of looking down. And I didn't pay much attention, except that I kind of wondered where he came from. Because as I said, there's only one way to come into this place. And we took it, and there wasn't anybody else there. We were the only car parked there. We were there by ourselves. We didn't hear another car come in. We didn't hear anybody walking down the path. We didn't see anybody. And this is a small cemetery. And I watched, and he kind of walked around just a little bit. And then I just said, okay, well, you know, I don't know who he was. I just missed him. And so I went back to what I was doing. I was looking at a stone or something. And it wasn't 5 minutes. I looked up again, and he was gone. And I asked my wife, I said, did you see that guy? And she said, no, I didn't see anybody. I said, okay. So I don't know if I had some kind of a spotting. I mean, it was kind of weird because, like I said, this is it's not an easy place to get to. You have to walk, do some walking, and there was just nobody around. We were there for quite some time before this person just suddenly showed up, at least just showed up in my vision. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that was, but it was very odd. And I just had the sense. Just, like you said, I'm not as sensitive either. Yet I still just had some feeling that was wrong somehow. You know, that he didn't belong there, or it wasn't right, or you know, sure. Something strange about that incident. So
and something was off, but you really couldn't quite put your finger on exactly what it was.
Yeah, right.
This is just an opinion question. Do you think the geography of Chicago has anything to do with it being such a haunted city? And what I mean by that is it having the lake right there, just the setting. Obviously, it's a very densely populated area. Anytime you have dense populations, your odds of ghost stories certainly goes up. But do you think the geography itself plays into it and its storied history?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I agree that certainly when you have a dense population, you know, the odds of having ghost stories and ghosts are much, much greater. But there is something I think about geography generally in some locations. I lived for 8 years in Athens, Ohio, which is the southeast part of the state. I was teaching at Ohio University there. And a lot of people believe that ley lines, which, you know, your audience may or may not know, that basically sort of lines of magnetic energy, that a lot of them, and they're all around the world, that the Athens area is an area where a lot of them come together or sort of intersect each other. So they consider it a focus of a lot of energy, primarily magnetic energy. And there's a lot of hauntings and a lot of stories from Athens, going way back to the spiritualists who built the spiritualist church there back in the early 1800s. And even further back to the Shawnee Indians who considered it a sacred site, a site of spirits, and would never camp there or anything, but would use it sort of for, I don't want to say religious purposes, but Yeah, I guess kind of religious purposes, spiritual purposes. So is there something to that? Is there something to all that magnetic energy crossing there that does that? I don't know about Chicago. There is something as well about water. You did mention that, you know, being on the lake and everything else. You have the Chicago River. There is something about the energy of water, water energy, possibly being, again, a source of energy that might be beneficial to witness spirits, that spirits manifest or whatever. This is assuming that we all agree that they are somehow creatures of energy, and you know, we don't have any proof of that, but that is kind of the common theory, that you know, ghosts need energy to materialize or whatever, and that's what they are, is essentially energy. So yeah, there could be something in the hydraulics of the Chicago area. I don't know anything about what's under the ground up there, you know, whether there's magnetic kinds of minerals or anything else like that might also do it. But I do think there's something to geography. I think there is a connection to geography and hauntings. Yeah.
I know we're not, so take us off the topic of Chicago, but while we still have a little bit of time, I wanted to talk about another area of the book that you talk about with hauntings, and that would be in Springfield, Illinois, with the Abraham Lincoln, the memorial, and some of the other areas that reportedly have activity. Could you share the stories of that?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, the Lincoln Memorial, the Lincoln Tomb, I mean, that's well known. There's been stories about that forever. But, you know, the stories basically are that people say you can hear, if you go into the tomb, that you can hear mourners, you can hear people weeping about the death, apparently. And of course, it's kind of a strange story in that, you know, at one time there were grave robbers that tried to steal Lincoln's body and came close to doing that, but they were broke. They were discovered by Pinkertons and, foiled before they had a chance to actually do it, but that could have happened. And so people say that, you know, poor Abraham Lincoln is not resting easy. His body has been, I guess, moved and sort of reburied, if you will, several times before finally coming to rest in the tomb where it is now. And his son Robert, the last time that the tomb was actually opened, they actually opened it to sort of inspect the body. And his son Robert was an adult at that time, so it was several, you know, many years after he had died. And Robert again verified that, but this time he ordered that they bury something like 20 feet of concrete or something above the casket, which is buried deep below ground. So, you know, I think he's safe now. Yet people say that they'll see him walking around. And of course, his son, I forgot which one, died in Washington. It was Willie, I think, I don't recall. But he died young, and they say they see his ghost there too. But I visited the Lincoln home in Springfield, the house that he lived in just before leaving for the White House for the presidency. And this is funny because that place has stories too. One thing is that there's a rocker in the living room that was supposedly one of his favorite rocking chairs, and that will rock on its own. And there's the famous mirror hanging up there in which Lincoln supposedly had a vision where he looked in the mirror and he saw two images of himself. One was his sort of natural image of that day, how he looked that day. The other one he described as, you know, being sort of pale and sort of wan and old looking. And he took that as a sign that he would not survive the presidency, that seemed to be to him almost like a death mask in a way. And that mirror is still there too. So as he went on the tour, you don't walk on your own. You can't just go wandering through the house and linger in the rooms. You go with a park ranger. And they take you through, and they give you just a couple of minutes in each room, and then they move you through the next one. So as we about halfway through the tour, I asked the park ranger, I said, so, what's with the story about, you know, some of the hauntings here and the ghost stories and everything? What's going on with that? And he gave me a look, and he just said, there's nothing like that going on here. Let's move on to the next room now. And I said, okay. And I found this to be sort of the government approach when I've been in other historic places like that. You talk to the park rangers and they won't they won't answer those questions. So anyway,
I've discovered the same thing. And I wonder, is there repercussions if they speak of such things, or what is the,
I don't know.
It is a very harsh reaction that you get when you talk to anyone in government about anything haunted related. And it's very much, harsh, like you just offended them in some way, shape or form.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know what that is.
Well, I investigated the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base Museum here in Dayton, Ohio, which is an enormous museum. And again, talking about spirits attaching themselves to things, you know, you have all these airplanes and helicopters used in warfare. There's a lot of, you know, unfortunate stories attached to them. And so I had some questions there, and I approached one of the docents, and he almost threw me out. I mean, I can't believe how annoyed he got. And he said, you have to send all your questions. There's a form at the front desk. All your questions you have to fill out and send to Washington, D.C., and they'll answer them. I said, yeah, they're not going to answer them.
Yeah.
But anyway. Wow. But you know, the funny thing is, there was a park ranger at Gettysburg for many years, a guy named Mark Nesbitt, who for many years was a park ranger, and he would give you all the scoop on Gettysburg, you know, knew all the facts about the battles and everything else, you know, minute to minute, he can give you all that. Never say anything about ghosts. Once he retired, he became Mark Nesbitt, Gettysburg Ghost Hunter. I mean, he runs ghost tours, mm-hmm. and he's written books about it, and he can tell you all about the ghosts. So he knew about those all the time. But you know, I guess it's the party line. I guess you work for the government and you don't talk about those.
That wraps up part two of our interview about haunted Chicago. A big thank you to our guest today, John Kashuba. We appreciate his insight into the ghost stories around Illinois and the city of Chicago. Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.